For almost 2,000 years, the Catholic Church has pointed the way toward salvation through Jesus Christ. For each of us, that journey starts in darkness, as if in a cave. We invite you now to come with us as we seek wisdom and truth by way of faith and reason with your guides, Mark Tuttle and Timothy O'Donnell. Join us in the Catholic Cave. Welcome once again to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford. In the cave with me, Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell, and gentlemen, the Right to Life dinner is coming up next week. And let's see, is that Monday night?
That's Tuesday night.
Tuesday night. Okay.
Tuesday, October 1st.
So if you're listening to this Tuesday at noon, you may still be able to get in.
We take walk-ins really up through the reservation deadline is really kind of the end of Friday the 29th would be the absolute, I think, last time that we would take a reservation. But we always take walk-ins, so people can come in and notify our office that they're going to be there, and we'll find a place for you. If you come in twos, we may not be able to sit you together, but we'll find a place for you.
Okay. And the reason why I bring that up is simply because we are going to share with you an interview that we've done with the speaker for that night, Star Parker.
Yeah, we're so excited. Yeah.
After hearing this interview, I really, really have to believe you'll want to be there, because she has hit home on so many topics of critical nature here within the United States, within the world, in just these, 30 to 40 minutes that we had the chance to talk to her, that I think you'll want to be there. So we're going to take a short break. We're going to come back with the interview with Star Parker, and we'll bring it all to you right here on the Catholic Cave. You're listening to Catholic Radio Indy, converting the culture to Christ through radio, featuring 100% Catholic programming 24/7. Do your friends a favor. Tell them about Catholic Radio Indy. Right to Life Indianapolis invites you and your friends to their 37th annual Celebrate Life dinner. This year's event will be on Tuesday, October 1st, at the Marriott in downtown Indianapolis. Noted political commentator and author Star Parker will be the keynote speaker. Join the effort to build a culture of life in central Indiana. For tickets, visit rtlindy.org or call 317-582-1526.
Have you ever thought about joining the Catholic Church? Have you just wanted to explore the Catholic faith? All you need to do is call your local Catholic Church for more information. We are always happy to help you in your journey to discover and learn more about the Catholic faith. We have classes that are almost year-round, and the classes and information sessions do not involve making a commitment, and there is no pressure to join. Please call your local Catholic parish for more information today and start the journey of one day possibly becoming Catholic as well. God bless.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Timothy O'Donnell, and still in the cave is Mark Tuttle, Kent Blanford, and we are super thrilled to share with you and introduce our special guest, Star Parker. She's the founder of the Center for Urban Renewal and Education, or CURE, founded in 1995. Many of you listening may, I'm sure, are already familiar with Star, but she's, just for background purposes, she's a author, speaker, political commentator. She will be coming to the Right to Life of Indianapolis Celebrate Life Dinner as our keynote speaker. So we're super excited about to have that. And welcome, Star Parker, to the Catholic Cave.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you, and I'm looking so forward to being in Indianapolis again. It's a great city, and I have adorable friends there.
Well, fantastic. And you've got two new ones, and Mark and I. And Kent. Oh, and Kent, too.
Okay.
So I'd love to jump in a little bit. Could you share a little bit with our audience, a little bit about your background and CURE?
Well, yes, I'm in Washington, D.C. with CURE because I'm trying to solve some of the problems of culture and poverty and race relations through my organization, mostly based on a call that the Lord put on my life because of the challenges that we have in culture and in poverty and in our race relations, and that I knew firsthand the damage that it can do to individuals. And I think that that's one of the reasons he tapped me for this work, because I believed the lies of the left as I say often, in listening to some of the dialogue about impoverished and the state of affairs for those that are just struggling through to find their purpose in life, and in believing those lies, the same lies we hear today, that our problems are somebody else's fault, that, you know, America's racist, so don't mainstream, that I'm poor because others are wealthy. And in hearing those lies constantly with no balance of scripture or no Christian background whatsoever, I got lost as many get lost. And I got lost in then just living day to day, and very early in life started getting involved in criminal activity and drug activity and sexual activity and abortion activity and welfare activity and just carving out a little dark hole for myself, thinking that that was going to be reality forever, until the Lord saw me down there and picked me up, introduced me to himself, and I said yes, and the next thing I know, I'm learning scripture and I'm pulling myself together. I got into college and got a degree in marketing and business, international business. I started a business. It started going very well. My life started turning around, as most lives do when you really just trust the Lord to guide you. And then the 1992 Los Angeles riots woke up my reality, or I should say unsettled my reality at that point, because it destroyed all of the businesses that were supporting my then magazine. And I had already come across many scriptures that showed me that we weren't doing our anti-poverty programs correctly, that we were building out this welfare state and the dependency on government that was not good for the people that were trapped in that program. I had lived in and out of it 7 years, 3.5 years consistently. So I began to speak out, and in speaking out, I got national attention, began to work on social reform and social policy, what then led me to consult with the GOP Congress as they were moving to change welfare policy. In those changes, we were able to reform welfare in the middle of the 90s. And as a result, I thought, well, you know what? It's one thing to say what we shouldn't be doing, but it's another to say, then what should we be doing for those 4,000 that are trapped in our, you know, welfare dependency, you know, housing projects? We have about 4,000 of those now. We have about 9 million people that's their whole existence. And then it touches on other areas, you know, when you start putting in food stamps and the, you know, charity programs with child care and other things. And so it was just becoming a real mess for where people were looking for their guidance to how they could live a peaceful life. And so I wanted to focus on what should we be looking at, and that's when I founded CURE. And as a result of founding CURE, I started organizing the pastors that are in these hard communities to start getting them information about new ideas of how we should be addressing poverty. And that's how CURE started, and that's what we do now. About 10 years ago, I moved it full-time here to Washington, D.C., so that we can change laws, or help change laws, so that we can really help people change their lives.
Now, you've made an emphasis, and I've seen you on Fox News, I've heard you speak, you've made an emphasis on the role that pastors need to play in poverty reform and reaching out to the poor. What's the cause of that? I guess if you had, and playing the blame game is always difficult, but if you had to lay the blame somewhere, is it the pastor's fault to a certain extent that there hasn't been more involvement of the church in poverty issues, or is it more the government's fault for kind of stepping in and sort of usurping that role?
I think that public policy affects people's personal behaviors, and behaviors then influence opinion. And what we saw was the government come in with a war on poverty in the 60s, thinking that it was its role to pool resources to try to help people in their state of affairs. And yet, I believe that the role of charity belongs to the church and local communities, not the government. The rules of the government have to be for all. So the rules basically became don't work, don't save, don't get married, and that will qualify you for welfare benefits to be engaged with the government. And so I don't know if I can put the 100% blame on the church and or the government. I think that nature abhors a vacuum, and with the people of God not being that church in their local communities, it allowed for the government to move in an area that it should not have been. And as a result, we now have a swelling government dependency, which has now really created an environment of chaos in our general population, but it has also built big government to think that it should be in a lot of areas that it should not. We have spent $22 trillion in this war on poverty. We spend $900 billion a year in anti-poverty programs, and yet, and that's every year on all of these anti-poverty programs, and yet we haven't moved the poverty percentage. It's still hovering right about 24% of our population as it was in the 60s. But you got to ask yourself, first of all, is money the problem? Because why haven't we moved the percentage? It's not the same people, but it's certainly right about the same portion of our population. But what did change when government moved in to take care of the poor is their behaviors. The public policy changed behaviors. When you tell somebody that if you have a mistake in your life and you get pregnant and you go into business with the government, you can't marry that person who got you pregnant, over time, marriage started unraveling. And now we're looking at the poverty in all of our communities. I mean, I do data. That's what we do here at CURE. And when you look at data, it breaks down to just two things that have happened as for the poor, and that is collapsed ethics and collapsed marriage. This is where we see poverty. People are not working because the government doesn't reward work when it comes to those dependent on it. People are not marrying because the government doesn't reward marriage when you are on one of their programs. In fact, if you're living in a Section 8 home and you want to marry the man of the three children, you are going to be put out of that home. So people started behaving differently. And when people behave differently, then it touches into the opinions of the people that know them. And the next thing you know, we're building more government program. So where's the role of the church? Do I put lay some of the blame at the feet of the pastor? Yes. Because the pastor is the leader of the people in the church to help them understand that they need to be active in their local outreaches. They need to be active in the nonprofit world that are serving the poor. Every community has outreaches that are serving in these areas that we know people need help, whether it's a single mom who needs just a little bit of help, whether it's a drug addict, whether it's a homeless person, whether it's an abused, in every single area. And we know that, especially as Catholic, because Catholic Charities has attempted, and the Catholic Church has attempted to be there, whether it's educating the children. The challenge is when you're in a relationship with government to do these things, you are not then able to really get down into the root cause of why people are trapped in their despair. So the pastors, yes, they must be engaged. They must be local agents in their community to know everybody that helps, so that the first order of business when someone has a crisis is not to go to government, it's to go to their church, because they know that at the church they will have the resources available to say, here's where you need to go to get that area in your life fixed.
Now, a lot of these behavior problems that you talk about, you know, we've grown up with, I think, a world where that's characteristic of the poor to a certain extent. But that hasn't always been the case. And I guess the question is are these changes in behavior, are those sort of a deliberate are those sort of a deliberate effect of the policy? Or is that sort of, growth of, the breakdown of the family, drug use, more crime, those types of things, is that a side effect of the policy? In other words, when the war on poverty came about in the 60s, was part of the intent to change the behavior of the poor and kind of bring in these sorts of problems?
Well, a lot of people are still assessing what the real intent of those that engineered the Great Society, and I don't know that the time will allow us to get into my personal opinions about that. I wrote a book on it. It's called Uncle Sam's Plantation, and I think that there was a lot of ill will behind those that thought that the government should move the church out of charity and move itself in. But to your question specifically, was the end result what we see now, where people are just lawless and recklessly out of control, a result of the government moving into anti-poverty? I would say absolutely yes, because prior to the 60s war on poverty, when you had a challenge in your life, your family moved in to try to help you fix that. We did not see the breakdown of family the way that we do today after the Great Society. Prior to that, even when you look at the most distressed and most vulnerable community amongst us, the black community at that time, marriage rates were high. At that point in our history, 70% of husbands were in their homes with their wives raising their children. So while they were poor, they were teaching values and virtues that would help their children break the cycle of poverty. There was big emphasis on getting yourself educated. There was big emphasis in a home to make sure that you're not out in the streets at 9 o'clock at night wreaking havoc on your neighbor. Once we removed the husband from the home, we started seeing increases in promiscuity among young women, and we started seeing more violent behavior among young men. So, yes, I think that the government role has increased some of the challenges that we're seeing today. When we look at where we are in our society today, 70% of those young men that are in our criminal justice system are coming from single-headed households. Are they disproportionate African American? Yes. Why? Because this was the most vulnerable community when they started this social engineering in the 60s. The black community came out of a journey of slavery in this country, through the journey of Jim Crow and racism in this country and segregation in this country, and then immediately moved into, instead of freedom, into a welfare state, into a government that said, we will fix this and we will do it through these government programs, but here are the rules. You can't marry, you can't save any money, and you can't be working. And this has created a challenge to where it just totally broke down. 5 years after Dr. King's death, Roe v. Wade was national law. So, and they preyed then on this very vulnerable community who is now without father in the home, married to the mother of the children. The next thing you know, you get very, very lost. And I know firsthand how lost people can become when they do not have that clarity, not just in their home life. But remember, at the same time, religion was being dismantled in our country as well. I mean, we scrubbed our schools from all reference to God in those same 60s. Then you had a feminist movement that began to collapse marriage. And then you had a government that said, don't worry about any natural consequences. We now have these safety nets. So, yes, people then behave very differently when they don't have that social structure and a community and a culture that says certain behaviors are unacceptable.
And we're speaking with a very special guest, Star Parker. She is the founder of the Center for Urban Renewal and Education, or CURE. She's a political writer, commentator, author of many books, and also will be the keynote speaker at the upcoming Right to Life of Indianapolis Celebrate Life Dinner. And Star, you've been laying out a lot of different sort of causal effects. Now, a lot of what you're sharing for many people in our country, you know, sort of antithetical and flies in the face of, you know, what can be generally accepted in secular society about. So what's wrong with, if anything, what's wrong with things like promoting contraception, promoting abortion, because that's that allows women to, have control over their own bodies, choose their own destiny, be more in control of what's happening to them. It sounds like you're not, you've got a different message, but conventional sort of conventional sort of setting right now is that, we need to promote contraception and abortion for women to really be free and liberated. What's your take on that?
My take is that it's in direct conflict with a biblical worldview. And when you think about the Bible and you think about Christianity, one of the benefits and the beauty is that then we can maintain a civil society, because the scripture forces one to be personally responsible. It's about being responsible with the choices that you make when you live individually. When you live collectively, which is secularism, then you can do whatever you want to anytime you want to. And that is not a civil society. You cannot have people just making up the rules as they go along. Situational ethics doesn't work for any society, and that's the reason we have such challenge now with this interjection in our culture to say, hey, if you want to be promiscuous, there's no problem. we'll fix it later. We'll fix it if it's an HIV. We'll fix it if you get pregnant. We'll fix it if you don't want to stay pregnant. This is not healthy for not just family and traditional family living, where husbands are valued in the home with their wives raising the children, but it's also ineffective when it comes out to the general masses, to where you have people afraid of each other because everybody is so secularized and there's no real rule of law. Without a rule of law and a guidance in what kind of ethics we will have as a community of people, then you reduce yourself to what one social scientist called the tragedy of the commons. No one owns it, no one takes care of it, no one is responsible for their neighbor anymore, and the next thing you know, government gets bigger and tries to solve very, very local problems, and it's not working for anyone. It's not only affecting the black community horrifically, it's now in our general culture to where marriage has broke down. In those same 60s, when you look at white marriage rates, you had about 3% of the people there who had children outside of marriage. Today, this population has 30% of their children being born outside of marriage. And that's why we're starting to see some of the same social pathologies that we thought were confined just to our really hard pockets are now out into the general society. And that's one of the reasons that even in your suburbs, they're now having homeless problems and drug problems and all of the other pathologies that come from breakdown of family life. So to simplify the answer, it's God or government. We're either going to be biblically and free as a society, or we're going to be secular and statist. We're going to have government determine every area where we move in our lives just to keep a civil society.
I'm really interested. I appreciate that point of view and perspective, and I really agree with it. Let me zero in just a little bit, if I may, on the abortion issue. I think there's good factual evidence and historical evidence to see that abortion is real in our legalized abortion in our country really can be traced back in large part to Margaret Sanger and her specific racist eugenics policy to target the African American community in the United States and to limit the size of African American families and others that she saw as undesirable elements of our population. What trajectory do you see abortion, having the arc of abortion across the last almost century in the United States, and where has legalized abortion gotten us?
Well, first, we know that abortion is a crime against humanity, so we should not be doing it. This abortion in our society today is what slavery was in our society yesterday. We should not be doing it. It is a violation of human nature and humankind. So we know that. Now, to the specifics of the eugenicists and the environmentalists and why they would target the poor, and why, which then disproportionately hits black people, is because they do not believe that these people have anything to contribute. You know, it's very, very different from how God sees us. He sees us so equal. He sees us in his creation, and then he distributes gifts and talents. So from God's perspective, everybody is unique, and everybody has something that they can do and contribute to make our world better, to create like he created. But the worldview of the secularists is not like that. The worldview of the eugenicists and the environmentalists is not like that. They think that we're going to run out of resources, and so they want the survival of just the big guy, the survival of the fittest. And they believe, including Margaret Sanger, that there are some that just don't have this ability. So the best thing to do is to rid ourselves of them, whether they're African-American, whether they are impoverished, whether they are handicapped, rid ourselves of them so that it won't cost us in many, many areas. Number one, we don't even want to see it. But number two, we don't want it to cost us. And therefore, you have this insistence throughout history of mankind of killing off those that you find undesirable. But did Margaret Sanger bring that concept to our society and entrench it? Absolutely. When you get to the place where you buy into Planned Parenthood and their eugenicist model, you are saying that one person is better than the other, and now we're going to allow for society to decide which one by luring women, vulnerable women, women who sometimes more often than not just made a mistake, and we're going to lure them into thinking that there's nothing wrong with killing their offspring. The messaging of Planned Parenthood have been damaging. They have killed off in the black community almost 20 million. And this is unacceptable, not just because of the capital that we're losing, that human worth that we're losing, but also because it's a violation to God. This is a crime against humanity to interject ourselves in what God calls a reward, to birth someone, to put someone in someone's womb. This is a blessing for that woman to bring forth who knows what potential. And yet we as a society have allowed to interject ourselves to say, well, we don't think that that's a good idea. So we're going to now lure people into thinking that it's just a matter of choice. It's their choice. And when you think about and you really get into the numbers, you find out that, yes, it is an organized plan of the eugenicists and the environmentalists so that they can have more.
We're talking right now with Star Parker, president and founder of CURE, the Center for Urban Renewal and Education. And Star, you were just talking about that sort of secular mentality, the mentality that values people based on what they can contribute to society. And, you know, it's a little bit like the story of the older fish that's swimming and comes across two young fish and he asks them, oh, hey, boys, how's the water? And they kind of look at each other and say, water, what's that? You know, I think when we get into talking about the secular ethics, we're also inundated with it, so we don't even notice it. But I also kind of get the feeling that that's changing a little bit, that more and more people are becoming aware that this is a problematic worldview and are turning back to the church. What is there reason to hope that there's kind of a renewal bubbling beneath the surface of current affairs a little bit?
Oh, absolutely. My new book that's coming out in a month, the title is Necessary Noise, How Donald Trump is inflaming the culture war and why this is good news for America. And the reason I wrote this book is to your exact question, because what many are now waking up to is the reality of what secularism really looks like, especially when they couple themselves with big government that then starts to force these ideas on you when you don't readily accept them. Most people now are touched by the challenges that we've been clarion calling that would happen if you dismantle family life and religion in our society. They're starting to feel that reality in their personal lives. So, yes, I actually think that this is a window of opportunity for us to have a national debate about which society are we going to have in the public square. Are we going to be biblical and free, or are we going to be secular and statist? Now, does that mean that we're going to force our religion down people's throats? Well, absolutely not. Even serving the Lord is choice. But as a culture, you got to get your rules from somewhere. So you're going to get them from God or you're going to get them from government. And that's the discussion that we're having today. And, yes, I think that there are many, many more people that are open to hear that, because as that fish, we took for granted a society that where marriage was traditional, where you were afraid to come home late at night as a young girl because your dad was going to be standing at the door. You don't have that anymore. You have your dad in the household that takes that energy of a young boy bubbling up, and he channeled it towards sports or towards studies. Instead, now, we're allowing, since dad's not there, for them to channel that energy towards sexual promiscuity. So, yes, I think that most people in America now are starting to say something really has gone wrong. So they're open for these discussions. There was a point that it was isolated and only over there and the most vulnerable and the most impoverished, and if it didn't come to my community, I wasn't thinking about it much. But today, everybody is touched by big government and secularism. When you get to the place to where five-year-olds are able to tell their parents that, I don't know if I'm a boy or girl, and you have a society that now comes in against that parent, there's something really gone wrong. When you get to the place where you can't even put your boy in the Boy Scouts to learn some sporting activity and then not have to wonder if he's going to be preyed on by a homosexual, then there's something wrong in the culture. When you get to the place where you, if you just have a homeless shelter where you're trying to help women recover from some big challenges in their lives, but you're in court because of a boy wants to pretend he's a girl and come to that shelter, we as a society now have to address these things.
You know, that I really appreciate that perspective and really agree with it. One social ill we haven't touched on, though, is pornography. What's your take on pornography?
pornography is a directly result of allowing men to skirt marriage and entertain themselves. Mankind has certain, I guess you could say, propensities.
Mm-hmm.
And the traditional way of dealing with them is that you get married and you work out your salvation with someone else who deeply cares about you so that you both can be better people. And you bring others into the world and you teach them those same traditions and values. The best and the most beautiful in our society, they are those that say, I was married 50, 60 years and our children are just fine. But when you say as a society, these things are not important, why would you want to believe in an absolute God? What marriage? This is bondage. Oh, my goodness. You need somebody to help you? Well, we'll force your neighbor to help you through a government tax program. Then, yes, men get lost. The social stabilizer in society is the woman, the biological clock. God did that on purpose so that he could stabilize the society so that we can live into the future. And when you manipulate that clock, whether through contraceptives or abortion, when you tell men you don't have to marry, yeah, pornography is an escape. And you know what's really fascinating and disgusting is that now women are starting to engage in pornography mm-hmm. because it is filling in that empty space that marriage used to fill.
Yeah, I think pornography introduces, I mean, I think it's very, very corrosive on our culture and especially family life, because it not only has very strong addictive properties to it. Men we've seen, and increasingly you're right, women, but men are easily addicted to pornography, and it introduces an unfair and unjust and unrealistic competition within that marital relationship. And it, we found younger and younger ages, our children are being exposed to it because of the power of technology, you know, smartphones, et cetera, tablets and all that. And that there's, there are companies that are out there that are on the internet that are eager to find our children and present them with these disgusting images and corrupt their minds and their souls.
And it is corrupting, and it is addicting, and it is, because it has all, it's luring, it's lust. And as the scripture tells us, that when lust conceives, it brings death. You're absolutely right, and it will bring death to a marriage and it'll bring death to people who haven't married yet, because it is, the scripture, the Lord himself told us that a little leaven leavens the lump. Once you start exposing yourself to pornography, the addiction is going to be the result, because you that lust conceived. Once you start getting there, you need more. And this is one of the challenges, and it's also one of the reasons that now men won't marry women. They have all of these alternatives, and we're unraveling. We are unraveling. So back to the other question, is there opportunity for the church to be the church? It absolutely is. And that's one of the reasons that through CURE, we engage the clergy and speak specifically to them through our program, so they will understand how these decisions are affecting their community, their own lives, but also how public policy has encouraged these decisions. Because it used to be illegal. That's public policy. It used to be illegal. You want an underground, you want a dark world, fine. You can never get rid of that. But once you start legalizing any types of activities that are out of the social norm, then people are going to participate. And the next thing you know, it's out of control. And it's exactly what you're saying. The next thing you know, you got 6-7-year-olds that are engaging in pornography. And now they're really distorted in what true sexuality is about and what God's way of doing business in your sexual sphere is about.
So we've talked a lot about the social pathologies that are out there and what's plaguing our society. What's the prescription? I mean, what do we need to be doing, particularly as individuals? What do we need to be doing to try to reverse course and kind of heal our culture?
Well, in our own individual lives, we can start going to church again, I suppose. I mean, 100 million still get up and go to church on Sunday morning.
Right.
We probably should double that number.
Yeah.
But in the personal, I mean, I get up every day and still read the scripture. You got to get up and you got to fill yourself with God's word, because once you walk out that door, you're going to be inundated. I don't even go to movies because, you know, to that pornography question, are you kidding? I'm a single woman. I don't need to expose myself to that. Especially in a dark room with a lot of strangers, this is crazy. So individually, we need to make our own.
That's a great point.
Well, we need to make choices individually, and it's hard to make hard choices to say I'm not going to participate. But as a corporate, we need to look at policy. Policy is what is making these things happen. When you say it's okay, when the government runs the schools, or they fund the schools, and the unions run the schools, it is not okay what they're teaching in these schools. So we have to have somebody in charge of the Department of Education that understands a worldview rooted in the scripture, and that's where voting comes in. If we vote for people that believe that anybody can do anything that they want to, any time that they want to, and it's the church that has the bad ideas, and so therefore we're going to diminish their role in our society totally, and then we're going to build out big government to take care of any consequences that may result of lawless living, then we're going to get more of the same. But when we understand the value of our vote and that we need to have people in office that understand the principles that we were founded upon, which were Christianity, capitalism, and our Constitution, then you're going to start seeing the changes. One of the things that most of us in Washington that work on the conservative side of these issues are excited about under this new administration led by Trump is that they understand that side of the worldview. They understand that we need constitutional attorneys that are heading up our Supreme Court and our federal courts. They understand that in our departments, we need people that have a worldview that trust in man and mankind and local communities and the church to take care of those that are vulnerable or that might fall through the cracks, so that they start limiting the role of government, that they start deregulating in areas that don't belong here in Washington, D.C., but that belong more locally. So, voting is how we as a society rectify some of these challenges, but individually we have a role to play too.
Yeah, and I think you're exactly right. When you look at the secular worldview and you look at the Christian worldview, the biggest thing that separates them is that fundamental respect for human life, that understanding that the individual has dignity and worth simply because it's a creation of God, and that we're all created in the image and likeness of God. And then also, you know, that the social pathologies are out there aren't something that are systematic or something that's inherent in the system, or it's, you know, the man just trying to keep us all down. It's due to sinfulness. It's due to our own breakdown and our own sinfulness and that push. And that's why I'm so glad that you're going to be coming here to Indianapolis next week to speak at the Right to Life dinner, the Celebrate Life dinner that we have, because to me that trying to restore that central fundamental respect for all human life is kind of the beginning of the process of sort of turning this all around.
And we need to do that uniquely in our own lives, because when we start buying into the ideas of the left that people, you know, aren't the same, that humans, you know, based on your ethnicity and based on your, you know, these other factors, you're somehow different, then we're outside of how God sees us, even though we may have different talents. But when you talk about humanity, we are the same. So you're absolutely right. If individuals would start to see their world and everybody else in their world is equal to them, then we can start solving some of these problems. We begin to build out public policy that relates to individuals uniquely. And then we start to self-govern to make sure that we're helping those services that are available in our society. You mentioned the word dignity. One of the things that even in the church, we steal dignity when we do our food programs and our homeless programs, because one of the areas that really bothers me in us not thinking that these folks have any worth whatsoever, so we pity them to the degree that we don't think that we can really change their lives, is that we give things away. We shouldn't give anyone anything, because when you give it away, you've stolen their dignity. They're in the food line. Let them put at least a nickel on the table so that there's an exchange. You give it to them, their head is down, because now there's no exchange, and their kids see that. So you've stolen dignity. So when they take that bag of food home and they put it in front of their six-year-old and he says, I'm not eating that, I don't like that, you put your head down. But when you have bought that for a nickel, you put your head up and you say, you better eat it because I bought it. It's interesting how we look at our poor today, and as not uniquely made by God, but as someone that doesn't have the capacity to do anything with this side of eternity, with that little lot that they do have. When we start adjusting ourselves to believe that everybody has something that they could do and that they're uniquely made in the image of God, we start to view them as ourselves, then we're not going to expect all these freebies from them or give them. We're going to expect them to contribute something. And once someone contributes something, they build worth. You know, I remember my mom was on this side of eternity. They had a program up in New Jersey where she lived to where if you could fill a bag with whatever you could fill it with, it was going to cost you $5. $5, they had an open garden. You go out, and for $5, you can fill up that bag. Well, my mom was a gardener, and so she came from the South, so she knew how to lay food in there that she probably had $50 worth of food in that bag for $5. We have to have confidence in people. Even you look at our homeless population. Man, it's not like they're lazy. You got to get up and go and stand in front of the store to peddle. So why not allow for their... for that energy to be redirected into something useful in society.
That's such an excellent point. I've had the privilege of volunteering at a food pantry for the past 20 years, and that point that you made about stolen dignity is so true, and it's so difficult. I think for all of it, it's a lot easier to give people help when we want than accept help, and if we're not careful on how we go about that. Giving someone a handout often does slight their dignity versus a hand up, and so I really appreciate
especially
that.
Especially in a welfare culture, especially right. When a welfare is already looking at them that way. So if they came to that food bank and they had to bring a nickel, they'll bring their nickel, and they'll be proud to bring their nickel, and then they'll go and tell all their friends that, yeah, I got this for a nickel.
Right, yeah. That's excellent.
Well, I got a new dress. Yeah, oh, I like your dress. I got it for a nickel. But I had to go down to the handout, and they gave it to me, and their head was down, and they said, oh, thank you, Lord. And, they, you know, no, this is the wrong model for how we do charity. It's charity, and that's why the price is a nickel instead of $50.
Right.
But it certainly cannot be free. Otherwise, we're competing with the government because they're out there giving away things free, and but they have means tests, and the means tests are destroying people's lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we've been talking with Star Parker, founder and president of Center for Urban Renewal and Education. And unfortunately, Star, we're kind of coming to the end of our time here. If people wanted to follow your work, find out a little bit more about these issues, find out about what some of the policy proposals are that are out there, how would they find out more information about CURE?
Well, we're urbancure.org. Or if they look up Star Parker, they're going to find starparker.com, which is going to lead them to urbancure.org. And that would be a wonderful help because we are a nonprofit, 501c3. We have no relationship with government except to get them out of the poverty business and charity. So that we can make room for God's people to get back in. So I'm preparing the churches. You guys better be ready because we're sending it to you. I remember one time I was in front of the Senate hearing room and it was a preacher that I had to be against on that particular panel. And then he said, young lady, if you change welfare the way you're talking, those girls are going to end up on my doorstep. And so I said, excuse me. I looked at that pastor and said, I think that's a good idea.
Yep. Right. Well, this has really been a pleasure. I was really looking forward to it. We all were, to spending a little time with you today, Star. And gosh, thank you so much for all that you're doing. And we'd love to have you back on sometime in the near future.
I look forward to it. And I'm looking very, very forward to joining all of you there in Indianapolis.
Great. Thank you so much. God bless.
God bless.
For your faith,
it's completely changed my walk with Christ, and I'm so thankful to you guys for that.
For your life,
all I gotta do is turn it on and I'm lifted up.
You lift you up when you're feeling down.
Catholic Radio Indy.
Right to Life Indianapolis invites you and your friends to their 37th annual Celebrate Life Dinner. This year's event will be on Tuesday, October 1st at the Marriott in downtown Indianapolis. Noted political commentator and author Star Parker will be the keynote speaker. Join the effort to build a culture of life in central Indiana. For tickets, visit rtlindy.org or call 317-582-1526.
Catholic Radio Indy
gives so much hope to those who need it.
It's kind of a bright, shining star in the radio today.
You can hear the Holy Mass every day at 8 a.m. right here on Catholic Radio Indy.
Welcome back to the Catholic Cave. I'm Kent Blanford in the cave with me, still Mr. Mark Tuttle, Mr. Timothy O'Donnell. We just finished speaking with Star Parker, who will be the speaker at the Indian Right to Life dinner on this coming week. And I got to say, when she finished that interview, we finished the interview, shut down the mics, and I looked at the guys in the studio, and the words that came out of my mouth were, "Dear God, why can't everybody make that much sense?"
Yeah. She was awesome.
She does. She makes a lot of sense. And part of the reason why is she connects so many of what people see as different issues. She connects them all and shows the thread that goes between them and shows how they're all interrelated and how honestly the remedy for them is interrelated.
Yeah, I really appreciated. She kind of left no social pathology stone unturned. You know, we talked about a lot of it, a lot of different issues that were going on, and how these various causes, despite, say, good intentions, like a good intention, of course, would be alleviating the suffering of the poor, but bad policy, even if it's related to good intentions, can have really detrimental effect. And it really resonated with me when she said, you know, look, I think a lot of people are waking up to looking at the state of affairs in our country and saying something has gone horribly wrong. And it's not one thing. It's the culmination of all these different things that I think has resulted in this really kind of plummeting free for all.
Yeah. And that's why I think her message is so important, because people need to realize that what has gone wrong is all of these remedies that we've tried in the past to solve the things that have gone wrong. So it's kind of, you know, people are flailing around going, what do we do? What do we do to solve these? And they keep looking back towards more policies and
bigger government.
And exactly. More government intervention.
Central planning.
And she's exactly right. You know, it's that type of intervention in a lot of ways that has contributed to a lot of these problems.
Yeah. And I would say, too, what I found a lot of affinity with is, you know, she's not Catholic, but her articulation of some of her social doctrine, it was very compatible with Catholic social teaching.
Definitely.
She didn't use the word, but like subsidiarity to me came to mind in a lot of what she was saying. And when we were thinking about, one, it was some of these government policies, the welfare state has attacked and subverted subsidiarity. It's also attacked and subverted the role of the family. That was a theme she brought up time and again. And I think it's absolutely true. You know, without stable marriages of moms and dads raising their biological children as the nucleus or foundation or core of society, then lots of unintended and sometimes intended bad consequences all happen.
Right. And, you know, the other big S in Catholic social teaching that she talks about and very much practices is solidarity.
You
know, and I think if you had to pinpoint why these government programs have often gone wrong, it's because of that lack of solidarity, that lack of ability to actually compassionately walk along with those people whom you're trying to help, to recognize their dignity rather than just throwing handouts at them, rather than just, you know, giving them free stuff. You know, to restore that dignity, you have to have solidarity, and you have to start from a standpoint of, you know, this is not your problem, this is our problem, and we're going to work together to solve, you know, this particular set of problems. And only the church can do that, really. I mean, that's something that only churches and pastors can step in to do. You can't have government bureaucrats able to do that just by nature of being a bureaucrat.
Right. She touched on a couple of things. One was, rightly so, you know, she pointed out and reminded us that the sphere of charity is properly belongs to the church. That's number one. And then number two, she again, going back, she again, I really touched on something important, which is coming back again and again to the dignity of human work. So even when you exchange, you know, in her example of a nickel for, you know, some goods that are being provided through, say, a food pantry or something like that, there's that in that sort of exchange, it does set, it does give a kind of recognition to work. And whether it's in the Catechism of the Catholic Church, the encyclical Centesimus Annus by St. John Paul the Great, or the Compendium of the Social Teaching of the Catholic Church, time and time again, we're reminded of that human dignity is just intrinsically related to work, and work brings out and help and causes human flourishing. And when we've when we deprive people of the work that they can do, that is how we are. It is a kind of dehumanization.
Yeah, because the nature of work is ultimately charitable. You know, we think of work as something that's drudgery, that you have to go, you have to work, you have to make your money to buy stuff, etc. But ultimately, when you're working, you're producing something on behalf of other people, and you're being compensated for it. But that charitable aspect of work is what bonds, in a lot of ways, I mean, obviously sexuality bonds families together also, but that secondary bond of a family is work. It's that going and giving of yourself for the sake of your wife, for the sake of your kids. And Star Parker really brought that aspect of, when you remove that aspect of work, that's where families start to break down, and that's why families start to have problems, because no longer are you bonding that family together through a charitable act of, I'm giving of myself for my wife and my kids, but suddenly somebody else is giving to me to take care of my wife and my kids. And it changes the dynamics, and that's where families, A, start to break down in existing families, but B, you set the stage for families never to even form.
Well, it's part of our shared common experience, I think, when we consider that when you've earned something, you tend to take much better care of it than if it's just sort of freely given to you. And so that's the way in which we perceive value of different things, whether it's relationships or material items. But before we run out of time, I do want to kind of get your reaction, Mark, to her comments on abortion, because obviously having invited her, and so grateful she accepted to be the keynote speaker at the Celebrate Life dinner. What was your what's your reaction to her comments on abortion?
You know, she did a great job of, as I said, connecting the dots to how devastating abortion is, even beyond just that individual life that's being destroyed. Mm-hmm. You know, we hear the stories of women who've had abortions, who suffer because of it, who are seeking out healing from it. But we continually have to make that scope bigger and start to see the devastating effects that it has on families, and beyond families, that it has on communities, and ultimately the devastating effect that abortion's having on our nation. I think we have a hard time imagining what the world would be like if there weren't abortion, and it affects so many aspects of our lives when you start to do that. You know, if you start to imagine, what would dating life on a college campus be if there wasn't contraception and abortion? It would be,
right.
You know, it would be
the proverbial game changer is what it would be.
It would be a proverbial game changer. But what would life? But here's the kicker to that question: what would life for a female student on a college campus be like, and how different would it be if there wasn't contraception and abortion? And I think most women will look at that and go, "Wow, yeah, that would be great." Quite honestly, life would be tremendously better if you didn't have those pressures there behind every social situation going on. So it's
Lila Rose talks a lot about that, actually. You know, about this strong pressure that adult women always be immediately sexually available, And that's not how it's always been.
Right. But what Star Parker brings out is how that lack of respect for human life, how that permeates everything else. And when you don't have that respect, when you don't have that dignity, then you lose the dignity of work. You lose the dignity of the family. You lose the dignity of individuals in the midst of that, because you've destroyed dignity on the front end by allowing abortion and allowing a policy that says it's okay to kill people when they're inconvenient to us.
Mm-hmm. And it all comes down to the simple fact that there is human dignity, because we are made in the image and likeness of God. And that's all the time we have for the Catholic Cave for this week. For Timothy O'Donnell, for Mark Tuttle, I'm Kent Blanford. Until next time, be holy.
The Catholic Cave is a production of Catholic Radio Indy. Replays of this program are available in podcast form at CatholicRadioIndy.org. Comments about this program can be addressed to kent@catholicradioindy.org or by calling 317-870-8400.
Did you miss something in this show or just want to hear it again? Podcasts of this and all our other great local programs are available 24/7 at catholicradioindy.org.